Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at MOFAD.org.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Valentine's Day. Whether it's your favorite day of the season or you avoid it like the plague, there's no debating it's a big day for the world of food and hospitality.
Valentine's Day is what we refer to in the industry as a blackout day.
I don't feel that my manlyhood is threatened when I order a glass of rosé or, God forbid, a rosé champagne.
It's an old Jamaican drink from way back, and we just decided to bring it back into existence. It's a drink that the men, they believe it really does wonders.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Food Without Borders Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Leah Kurtz, and today in the studio we have Michelle Carrera of Chili's on Wheels. Michelle is a Puerto Rican vegan food justice activist. She founded Chili's on Wheels in 2014 to make veganism accessible to communities in need. Now she started Casa Vegana de la Comunidad in Puerto Rico in 2018, and she also hosts a micro sanctuary. She was the co-founder of Latinos for Animal Protection in 2019, which served animal protection organizations in Latin America and organized a vegan Latinos in NYC meetup, which fundraised for Latin American vegan organizations from 2015 to 2017. She is a professional translator and ghostwriter and lives in Puerto Rico with her human unschooled child, rescued dog, and chicken companions. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, so good to have you here. So can you first tell me a little bit about where you grew up and maybe something like you remember eating as a kid that kind of stuck with you?
Yeah, so I grew up in Puerto Rico, in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico, which is a small town on the west side of the island. And half of my family is Cuban, so that was really the major food influence was the Cuban food. So like black bean soup would be one of my most treasured food memories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love Cuban black bean soup.
Yes.
And so what led you to kind of the work you do now? Was it a very long trajectory? Was it, you know, more recent? Kind of maybe a little backstory on what
yeah.
led you to...
So I've been vegan for like 18 years, and I went vegan actually in Puerto Rico. We had, my sister got a little chick for like Easter, and he grew into a rooster. And, you know, he answered to his name. He liked to cuddle. So that kind of made me see the person behind him. And so I couldn't eat any more animals after that. And in that process of caring about animals, I started caring about people as well. Like I realized that if we want animals to have the same rights as humans, then we have to, well, what about human rights, you know? So that kind of radicalized me. And I worked in a variety of nonprofits in different fields, immigration, adult literacy, reproductive rights. And everything kind of came together in 2014, right after Michael Brown was shot by police, all the marches, and then Darren Wilson was acquitted. And feeling that kind of burnout of the pointless fight, right? Feeling that kind of hopelessness, I just realized that I needed to do something positive. My son, who was 4 at the time, had also been part of these marches and had been part of these conversations. And I felt like that was a huge thing to put on a child so young. And so we needed to do something positive. So I looked for a vegan soup kitchen in New York, and that does not exist. Did not exist at the time. There were no meal programs in 2014 that were vegan.
Which is wild.
Right? In New York City. I mean, I couldn't even believe it. So I said, well, we'll just make the meals ourselves. And in my tiny kitchen with my tiny pots, I made like 15 meals. That's all that I could do with my pots.
What was that first meal that you made?
It was chili.
Right.
It was chili.
Right. What kind of chili, though?
So it was a three bean chili. And so we took it out in a little wheelie cart, hence the wheels. That's how it was. And we walked through the streets and we gave out the meals. It was Thanksgiving Day. So the streets were like deserted. It was very surreal. So it had that tinge of surrealness to it, which just made it all the more powerful, you know. And then hearing people's stories in the street that we were talking to and giving out the meals to. And I just kind of said, like, oh, we got to do this again.
What part of the city were you in?
Union Square.
Okay.
We went through Union Square. So imagine Union Square, like no cars, you know.
And it
was like
town.
And it was like the coldest day of the year that time. Like I think the first snow of the season. So it was, you know, everything just kind of came together to be like, wow, what is this day? You know, what are we going to do? So then we started doing it like once a month, and it was just a mother and son project. Like, it was just us two. And I don't know exactly. I think I posted it on Facebook or something, and some friends started getting really into it. People asked, like, oh, can I come with you next time? So that's kind of how it grew. Everything has been so organic in the way that it's developed.
And the conversations that you had with people and that you continue to have as you give out food, what do those tend to be?
They're anywhere, anything. They can be about veganism itself, like, oh, so this has meat or no meat, or what is that, you know, what does that mean? To I've had such a bad day, you know, and then going on to the bad day, or just anything about the weather, about anything. And that's, I think, that to me is the most important part of this work, is that those actual connections and conversations, being open to what where they can lead.
Yeah, and so one of the initial, I'm sure, kind of excuses that a lot of soup kitchens make for not having vegan food is the idea that people don't want to eat vegan food. And in your experience giving out food and, you know, hot meals and hearty, you know, chilies and meals, like, what has been the reception to the food itself?
Yeah, no, I mean, we've never, maybe once or twice we've had people that don't want it or that say, well, this isn't chili, this is rice and beans, you know. But for the most part, the reception is really well received. We make really delicious food too. People taste it and, you know, and also we've met a number of people that are vegetarian or vegan, that are living in the streets or that don't have the resources to get themselves, constant meals and there's no options for them. Mm-hmm. And they tell us that in the shelters or in the soup kitchens that even like what would be like a safe option, like a salad or something, it's already like drenched in dairy dressings. It's a huge accessibility issue.
Yeah, that is a disservice to people, whether it's for an ethical reason or just allergies that they can't find things.
Absolutely. We get people... we've made contact with like social workers and these programs, and we get people referred to us all the time. They have allergies, or they have ethical reasons, religious reasons. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that, people that don't eat meat for religious reasons. They get referred to us.
And had you had a lot of experience cooking like large quantities of food?
Oh my gosh, never.
Yeah, because that in and of itself is a feat, you know, scaling recipes. Like, were you getting donations for the ingredients for the food, or were you just doing it yourself?
And no, in the beginning, we were just making them ourselves. I started reaching out once we got started making them larger and larger amounts of food. I started reaching out to like supermarkets and things, and that's when they said like, "Well, we can't donate unless you're a nonprofit." And so that was the next step. So everything has been so organic because it was like, "Oh, so I got to make it a nonprofit to get the donations." And so that's how it kind of grew along, right? And now we have partnerships with vegan restaurants, and so instead of them wasting the food at the end, they just give us a call and we'll pick it up from them.
And have you had to educate a lot around like the Good Samaritan clause and things like that that protect businesses and grocery stores for giving food? Because there's still, I mean, I think that has changed a bit, but there was a lot of, even just a couple years ago, misinformation about whether you can give away food.
They still don't know in a lot of the cases. They still don't know, and they don't want to be liable. But yeah, everyone is protected. It's a federal law, the Good Samaritan food law.
And so what is a typical day doing Chili's on Wheels? What does that look like as far as the preparation? How many people tend to come and participate? And I mean, I know that it's grown. There are many chapters now, but perhaps the New York City chapter, like what kind of goes on when you give away the food?
Right. So, I mean, the process starts with either picking up the donations and having those kind of donations and then making the meals. We prepackage those foods. We don't actually serve it in the places that we distribute them. We prepackage them in to avoid like health code violations. So we already package them individually and bring them out in like insulated bags. And we set up in New York City. Our oldest chapter, original chapter, is in Tompkins Square Park. And we set up around 1:30 inside the park. And we have a little table and we have signs. We've incorporated like a free store as well with items of like hygiene products and these type of things that are also not tested on animals. So everything that we do is vegan all the way through. The clothing that we give out is also animal free. And people already know us. You know, we've been there for almost 5 years, so they wait for us. They come to see us. It's not a serving, you know, this kind of line of food. I'm gesturing a lot and that's not carried over, but it's not like a line of food where this volunteer is serving the meal and this other person that's in need is receiving it. So we all eat together. The volunteers eat the same food that we've prepared. And it's just a hanging out. It's what it is. It's like a social component to it is the most important part. We're all eating there together and talking.
Yeah, so it's more of like commensality and you're actually sharing a meal versus donating a meal, which I'm sure shifts the conversation and shifts the whole energy of that work.
Right, because we're all sharing whatever's in our lives, right? Like that we've already built these relationships with most of the people that are there, and then even newcomers just kind of join into that energy of us just hanging out together wherever we're at. So we're talking, we're not trying to solve people's problems. We're sharing our own as well. You know, we're talking about each other's problems together, and that just kind of helps to build those relationships and helps to grow, helps all of us grow.
Yeah. You made a really, good, I think it was an Instagram post recently kind of explaining that this isn't just for the homeless, it's for anyone in need, and kind of talking about the fine line between, well, first of all, homelessness and not being homeless. Like that can be one paycheck for some people, and also just being food insecure or just being hungry or just wanting to like share space with people. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we serve anyone that's going through the park. First of all, we set up in Tompkins Square Park, which is a there's all sorts of different people from different walks of life that are walking by. We serve people that are homeless. We serve people that are food insecure, which is, you know, they just $5 or $10, that's a lunch. That's a lot of money for, you know, for a lot of folks too, that can go into their heating bill or that can go into their, you know, we serve children and seniors, and we have people that live around the area and come and just hang out. We serve people that are walking by and they've never had a vegan donut, you know, and they, you know, you want to try a vegan donut, and then they just join into that conversation and join into that kind of relationship, right? You know, and folks that can make a donation for the donut if they want to. They don't have to. And yeah, so it's a lot. It's not so clear cut. Like you can say, oh, this is the community that we serve. We're just, it's just a, it's messy because we're all messy, right? Life is messy.
Yes. And then the work that you have been doing in Puerto Rico. So can you explain exactly what that is, how it differs from Chili's on Wheels, or how it's similar, and kind of what that looks like right now since you're back in New York City as well?
Oh, absolutely. So so I'm from Puerto Rico, right? And I still have family there. And so after the hurricane, that same day of the hurricane, I was pacing back and forth. What can I do? You know, I was feeling helpless. And I said, well, I'll just take in the food. And so 8 days after the hurricane in September of 2017, we went back there. We were able to catch a relief flight. And we did food relief. Within a month, we had done like 15,000 meals. Cooking in like, you know, there's no electricity. So we were cooking in like parking lots with like open fires. And yeah, it was very different from what our work here would be. There's a lot of institutions that weren't getting, that depended on the municipal government, and the government was MIA during that time. So these are like senior homes and orphanages and domestic violence shelters, and all these places were not getting the meals that they usually get from the government. So yeah, so we kind of stepped in and made those contacts and started giving out the food in those places. Since then, being in that space and talking to people about veganism, there was this huge gap in even knowing what that word was or having heard mm-hmm. that word. So the idea of like a permanent place where we could educate the community, where we could talk about these things, to workshops while creating community, that kind of came to be. So that's I went back. I left that December, a couple of months after. And I went back in January of the next year. And yeah, we started Casa Vegana de la Comunidad, which is a community house where we hold, these events, weekly events, which are very popular. They fill up really fast. People come and just learn how to cook vegan. There's a lot of interest in the health aspect of veganism. Mm-hmm. And so they come in, but they don't know what that looks like. They don't know what the food would look like or taste like. So there's apprehension in having to change their whole relationship to food, right? And we kind of make that accessible.
And are you veganizing a lot of Puerto Rican dishes? What kind of food are you cooking?
Yeah. So we still do Chili's on Wheels there. We do that 3 times a week, three different communities. And yeah, we just veganize Puerto Rican food. Arroz con pollo, it's with soy curls instead of, chicken. So that kind of thing we're doing. And the reception is really well. People ask us for help in transitioning to veganism. We have a kids workshop, so kids are actually cooking the food themselves.
Does Ollie host that?
he participates. So yeah,
one day,
So they're all really. It's very powerful to see that kind of change and to see those kind of relationships and to see the people come back like workshop after workshop. We see a lot of like familiar, you know, faces that come back. So it's really great.
And I know there is a small and growing kind of agricultural community as well, trying to return to growing the food there and building that up. Do you kind of have a relationship with those organizations or those people doing that work? And is that like integrated?
Yeah, we're starting to make those relationships. There's a couple of community gardens that have started up in some of the towns that we serve in. So we serve in 3 different towns. And so we're starting to make those community relationships to kind of, you know, to build these kind of networks at the same time. And so the concept of like veganic agriculture is very foreign. So we're kind of trying to provide these kind of resources or connect them with people that are doing this, like Grow As You Are in Atlanta. So because still, you know, like animal byproducts are still used in the growing of food. So we're trying to kind of provide those resources for folks.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick commercial break and then we'll be right back after this.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Welcome back to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Leah Kurtz, and today we have in the studio Michelle Carrera of Chili's on Wheels. Welcome back, Michelle.
Thank you.
So we're just talking about Michelle's work starting Chili's on Wheels in the United States primarily, and then starting Casa de Vegana, sorry, I'm messing it up.
Casa Vegana de la Comunidad.
In Puerto Rico. So I'm really interested in kind of the work you're doing, not just as, you know, like a vegan activist and a leftist activist, but as a mother, and you are incorporating, you know, your child as well into this work and, you know, raising another human being vegan and the way you're kind of like showing the ethics behind this, you know, this life and the way we eat, and not just eating, but living and moving and treating animals and humans in the world. Can you share some about that, like what you kind of bring to that, your approach to raising a child and specifically, you know, a vegan child?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's no doubt that he was going to be vegan or that I was going to raise him vegan because I had already been vegan for a lot of years before he was born. But it was very interesting to see how kids learn and how they're, you know, they're very black and white when they're starting to reason. And so it's seeing how, okay, so what does that mean? If you're eating animals, does that make you a bad person? And so there's a lot of these kind of, you know, morality that we kind of have to, you know, dance around, right? So it's not you're a bad person because you eat vegan. Let's help this person go vegan, or, you know, they might not be vegan yet. So that idea of not being vegan yet, or not doing the right thing yet, kind of came to be. And so we're also an unschooling family, and that kind of that really shapes how we kind of learn. So we don't go to school, we don't have hard rules. We allow each other to kind of be the way we are without imposing. And so, in choosing what we learn and in how we learn, with a social justice twist to it, right? Because that's what we do.
Yeah, that's. I liked what you said on Instagram as well the other day, kind of comparing the way that animals are treated and the idea of caretaking versus just like creating space for people to kind of achieve their own happiness, and the way that you kind of do that with your son, but then also with the animals that you share a home with, And can you talk a little bit about those animals too?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I call myself a facilitator. So I'm a facilitator in Ollie's and my son's learning and my son's not just learning, but approach in life in general. I facilitate his being in the world and his growing. And in that same way, I facilitate the animals that we have given refuge to, their agency and their living in the world. So, we found in the middle of the road, our dog, Lola, just in the middle of the Puerto Rican road. And she came to us. I opened the door to my car and she just kind of walked right up. And I was like, Wow. Okay, so you want to come with us? Okay. And so now she comes everywhere. She's traveled more than a lot of people have already. We also rescued two chickens that were in one of the communities that we serve. One of the folks, they were just like given these animals, almost like, take my problems away. Here's a dollar. Take the chicken, you know. And which is completely disrespectful and just yucky all around. So we took the chickens in, and they live in our house. They're indoor outdoor chickens.
Do they wear the little diaper
things? Yes. Okay. Yes. And they're, you know, chickens are just like dogs or just like cats, you know. They're very loving. They love to cuddle. They have their personalities, and they're very different in their personalities. And we just kind of make it a safe space for them to be who they are, without this tinge of we're taking care of them, we're caregivers, without centering ourselves, right? So we're trying to decenter ourselves from their lives and just kind of providing that kind of space, which I think is one of the most radical things that we can do as vegans, is provide refuge to typically farmed animals that would be, you know, slaughtered, would be killed, you know.
Yeah, and in a time in which mainstream veganism has kind of grown kind of dramatically in a very short amount of time, and it's not always politicized, it's not always there's not always a clear link between the food that is vegan and the activism that is vegan that speaks to humans as well as animals and the environment and all of that. And especially in a time in which, you know, we're kind of bombarded by politics have always been pretty terrible in this country, but it seems like they're, you know, increasingly in our face. How would you kind of link your activism across those different kind of pockets? They're not pockets. I guess they're very clearly linked. But I guess how does that look like for you?
Yeah. So I'm also on the board of the Micro Sanctuary Resource Center, and I think that everything is really linked. Everything is about what we can do from where we're at. Our story was we started doing the food from our pockets and you know, handing out the foods that we can do, that we can give from our kitchen. And so that's kind of where it goes. What can you do with where you are at right now? Taking ourselves out of the capitalist paradigm, right? Like a solidarity work, mutual aid work, and that kind of that extends to animals as well. What can we do with the space that we have? Do we have space to host, you know, provide refuge for one chicken? Even that is, you know, radical enough. What can we do with where we're with what physical space we have and resources we have, and then, you know, how does that extend to other things? So like food justice is so tied to that. Access to healthy foods is so important. Environmental work, we've talked about how communities of low income and people of color are the ones that are most affected by animal agriculture, and so we have to, right? We have to approach these things from all these type of different perspectives, but you can do it from where you're at. You don't have to have a nonprofit behind you, or you don't have to have these things. You don't have to have polished websites to do these kind of works, is what I'm saying. We all have a skill that we can provide, even if it's not a professional kind of, you know, look and skill.
Which I think is great to be reminded of, that it doesn't have to be already kind of ready and shiny and sparkly, mm-hmm. you know, just making a meal and taking it out to the closest park and offering it and sharing it with someone. That's how you started. And now it's grown, right? How many chapters is Chili's on Wheels?
We have 14, 14 chapters right now, but we're getting requests for it all the time. We have two in Hawaii, one in Maui, and one in Honolulu even, and then one in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And that's growing all the time. People get in touch with them, and they all look different. They all, because of geographical area, because of community needs, because of, the people themselves that provide the service, they all look kind of different. The Maui one, for example, is very rooted in those relationships with people, and they've gone so far as to like provide cataract surgery for one of the members and being able to navigate their insurance thing. So some of them are a lot more involved with the folks that they serve than others. In like larger cities, it's a little bit harder to kind of make those super in-depth relationships.
And what is involved in either starting a chapter or becoming part of a chapter that exists for people who might want to get involved?
In the website, we have everything kind of laid out for folks. They just get in touch with us and we'll kind of walk through them, seeing the area where they would, what they would do, how they would do it. It's just a conversation that we have with everyone. And it varies in the area that they're in.
Yeah, and so the work you're doing in Puerto Rico, do you feel like that gets, does that closely align with some of like the decolonizing work going on? Do those conversations come up in that approach to food and veganism, you know, specifically interweave in that community?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, decolonization is, it's a buzzword right now, so everyone's talking about it. But folks have been working for decolonization of Puerto Rico for so many decades. So it's not something that's new. In relation to food, we might be some of the people that are just starting to talk about that, about how our food is, how what we eat has been colonized, how we're the oldest colony. We've been a colony for over 500 years, since the Spanish came along. The Spanish were our first colonizers, and then the U.S. in 1898, and we still don't have, those are still our current colonizers. So there's been a change, absolutely. Like the what we call typical food in Puerto Rico is really coming from the Spaniards, the Spanish that introduced all these different things and all these animals that didn't exist in the island. And we can definitely see a shift after the U.S. came in how people are eating Burger King and they're eating all these fast food things that are coming from the U.S. So then the conversation becomes, so then what is culture? What is our culture? And how can we then shape, if we don't have a culture that's ours, that's been ours, then that means that we can shape it. That means that we can shape our culture going forward. And so what does that mean for our bodies? What's healthy? What do we want our food to be? And how do we want to approach freedom and liberation within our food system as well? Food that's produced in the island versus being shipped over, because that was something that happened. The U.S. kind of killed all the agriculture that was done in the island so that everything could be shipped over. And so there's a retaking of that. And so that's also important. Right.
Yeah. So do you see a lot of like not just cooking classes, but gardening or farming or that kind of, like you said, you're wanting to build some of those connections to expand that to not just how to cook food, but actually grow food?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a little food garden in the back that we started with some herbs and some things that people can do. But obviously our space is not large enough for that or built enough for that. So we've definitely started those kind of connections with community gardens in the area. To continue fostering that, because everything is connected, everything is, you know, linked together. Absolutely.
And so we were on a panel recently where you were talking about kind of working on being more authentically yourself and being more open about all the facets of your identity, not just as like Puerto Rican and vegan and activist, but also like as a queer person in the world. Can you talk a little bit about that, like in the space that you're creating, the intentionality of it being very inclusive and very like safe space?
Yeah, so that was something that it was a little hard for me going back to Puerto Rico. As someone that had lived there and then grown up there, and it's different when it's kind of like your own town, you know? There's something that might feel a little compartmentalizing when you're in that space, right? Like you, in a society that might have, because of colonization, let's be real, right? Like it's because we've been trained to follow the mainstream kind of paradigm of homophobia, people are not necessarily open to folks that are queer, right? And so there's that coming into that space, I kind of did feel like, shit, like I have to compartmentalize myself in order to be able to do the work, because otherwise people might not want to come, or people might not show up, or feel uncomfortable showing up. But then something I don't even know how I kind of came to that. I just kind of saw how the relationships that I was building with people weren't fully transformative, because when you're holding back on who you are, you're not able to build those kind of connections fully. They have an edge to them, and so I just kind of realized the importance of being completely authentically, completely open, and that extends to other identities too. Like if you go into a non-vegan space, you can't just hold back on your veganism, right? You have to, because then the relationship that you're building with those folks are not going to be that way open like that either. So so it's a whole, and it extends, you know, even beyond that. Like if you look at my Instagram, I'm like posting about like emotional trauma. Like it's an authenticity that extends everywhere. It's just kind of like just open it, ripping it all off and just letting whatever it is there come out.
Yeah, because you also never know who is in the room who needs to hear that, or who also feels alone, who has silenced or censored themselves because they also feel like I'm the only one here like right. this. And so you never know who you're going to kind of pull in a little closer because you're being more open.
Right. And also people, in part of learning in this process of community work, people want to help. People grow when they help. I've seen it in myself. I've grown when I'm in this helping mode. I've seen it in Ollie. Ollie grows when he's in his helping mode. And so everyone wants to grow. And when they're typically seen as someone who is in this vulnerable position, they're not allowed the opportunity to help. They're the ones being helped. When you're being helped all the time and not given that opportunity to kind of twist it around, there's no opportunity for you to grow because you're just taking in the help. So part of being authentic and part of being like, oh, I'm having such a bad day today, even though you're in a space with people who have much rougher days than you do, that gives them the opportunity too to step in and say like, well, and give their perspective and them growing in that kind of helping out someone, even if in comparison, it would be, I don't know how to explain that.
Right. But even they might have more wisdom because their life, you know, is harder depending on where they're at and, you know, like
right.
what's brought you together. So yeah, exactly. It just kind of levels the playing field, I guess, in a way, really beautifully.
Yeah, I think it comes from that mindset of who are you putting yourself to be? Like this kind of static kind of, I am the helper and you're the helpee. And it's so static, and it doesn't allow for anything beyond that. Whereas if you're just seeing people for who they are, you know, even, you know, whatever their circumstances are, then you get a chance to grow from them too.
Yeah, we all need each other.
Absolutely.
Michelle, is there anything coming up that people who are already kind of maybe involved or already know of Chili's on Wheels, or who have no relationship to Chili's on Wheels, who can kind of keep an eye out for things that are coming up on the horizon? Anything that you want to share?
We have a lot of projects within Chili's on Wheels coming out soon. We're developing this pilot program on using the going into like shelters and training the chefs in shelters to kind of do vegan meals from the food that they receive from federal aids. So we're definitely looking for people that we might want to get involved in that to help us train the people that are cooking in these large institutions. So that's kind of our biggest project. And, you know, obviously, if you feel the need to start a chapter, you can get involved with us, contact us, and we'll set you right up.
Yeah, and I highly recommend it. I've done it a couple times, and it's really fun. And, of course, you feel great, but you're also, yeah, feeding people as this very tangible sense of, you know, helping and joy, and also just sharing in a delicious meal because the food is really good. So thank you so much for coming and talking about your work. And you can find Chili's on Wheels at Chili's on Wheels on Instagram, Twitter,
Instagram, Facebook, and our website, chilisonwheels.org.
Great. And we'll be back next week with a new episode of Food Without Borders. I'm your host, Leah Kurtz, and you can find us on heritageradionetwork.org as well as iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.